You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When future historians write about the era we live in, which events will rank as the most important? Well, former United Nations Ambassador Kishore Mahbani suggests the rise of Asia as a major economic and political power will be near the top. His new book, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Power to the East, is published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased that it brings Ambassador Mahbubani to this show today. Hello.
Well, my pleasure to be here.
What are the four largest economies in the world predicted to be by 2050?
Number one, China. Number two, United States of America. Number three, India. Number four, Japan. But in the latest Goldman Sachs BRICS study, it shows that even India will overtake the United States by 2043.
Wow. So the United States, has been number one for how long?
Well, at least 100 years plus, if not more.
On the other hand, it's kind of understandable. China and India have such huge populations. It was only a matter of time, wasn't it?
It was a matter of time. But the curious thing is that why did China and India, which had the world's largest economies for 18 centuries, from the year 1 to the year 1820, why did they fall behind so much in the last 200 years, and why are they leaping ahead now? And my book answers those questions.
Before we get to that, What about the European Union? Wasn't it, or hasn't it, as a group, been as large an economy as the United States?
It is now. But some of the latest indications are that even as a group, the European Union will fall behind. And it's partly, as you mentioned earlier, a question of population and the fact that China and India with such large populations. And even if the Chinese and Indians begin to perform half as well as the Americans or the Europeans, they'll have a much larger economy because the total population is four times the size.
But didn't we hear similar predictions 20 years ago? Japan was projected as the next number one, and Americans started going crazy, and the Japanese were buying all of our buildings and everything. And then the economic bubble burst in Asia. And I wonder whether that's less likely today with India and China.
Well, that's a very good question. And indeed, there have been many false dawns in history. People have been predicting the rise of Latin America for a long time. Never happened, and so far hasn't happened. But I think in the case of Asia, you have many leading indicators which clearly indicate how Asia is going to perform. If you look at how well Chinese and Indians and other Asians do at North American universities, And if you look at an amazing statistic I found, which is that 90% of all PhDs in science and technology will be living in Asia in 2010. Now, that's a stunning reversal,
Because in the past, they would have come to live in the West, and there was the brain drain problem. Now they're going back home, or they're staying home?
It's a combination. I think more than the former Prime Minister of India was once asked, what do you think of this brain drain from India? And his reply, which I thought was very wise, was better a brain drain than a brain in the drain. And the wisdom of his remarks are shown now 20 years later in that many of the people who came to United States and Europe as part of the brain drain are now going back.
And now India has produced some of its own important institutions of higher learning.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the Indian Institutes of Technology, admission to the Indian Institutes of Technology is harder than admission to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, or MIT.
And how does it compare in terms of educating its students?
Well, I think I would say the North American universities are still much better because they provide you a kind of comprehensive education that you will not get in the IITs. But once you get admitted to the IITs and you graduate, boy, that's a tremendous meal ticket nowadays, because any of the leading multinational corporations will say, this guy survived a rigorous selection process. He's obviously one of the best.
Is IIT based on Western university systems?
Yes, but it's very focused on engineering and science.
Now, one of the ways that we see that an economy is doing as well is by the standard of living. How fast is the standard of living rising in the top Asian countries.
Well, this is another remarkable statistic that I came across. In the Industrial Revolution, when the West took off, you could expect an improvement in the standard of living of 50% in one lifetime. But when I sent my manuscript to Larry Summers, he produced this stunning statistic which said that in Asia, you'll see a similar improvement in standard of living, not by 50%, not by 100%, not 200%, but 10,000%.
That's almost as bad as inflation in Zimbabwe.
Now, it's a remarkable transformation. And I have actually personally lived through this transformation. Because when I was born in 1948, I mean, Singapore was a British colony. We had the same per capita income as Ghana. And today, for Singapore to have a per capita income as high as that of the United Kingdom is amazing. In one lifetime.
Do you think that that Singapore would be a major power if it weren't just a small city state?
Well, there are benefits to being small. Certainly, I think if we were much larger, it would have a much greater impact. But Singapore has played an enormously important catalytic role in transforming the mindset of people. When Deng Xiaoping came to Singapore in 1978, he expected to find in Singapore another third world city. He was actually personally quite shocked to see how advanced Singapore was. And I think he went back and he told the Chinese people, go learn from Singapore.
Well, Singapore and also Hong Kong, as former British colonies, bought into Western approaches. Mm. China was trying to go it alone, do other things. It's only been more recently that China has started emulating the West. Mm. The Japanese were the first during the Meiji era. Mm. But it took them a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, but that's where the really good news comes in, you know, because what Japan started doing initially with the Meiji Reformation, then again after World War II, was to implement what I call seven pillars of Western wisdom. And what the Japanese did, the four tigers, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore copied, and then Southeast Asia did, and then China, as you know, did so. And after China did so, India said, why not us? But the really good news, and I hope this will please your listeners, is that this march to modernity, which I speak about in the book, is now marching into the Islamic world. And if the Islamic world modernizes in the same way as, you know, East Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia, believe me, we're going to have a happier and more stable world.
My guest is Kishore Mahbubani, whose book, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East, is published by Public Affairs. Well, what happened with Japan is that it started booming because of it had cheap labor. Mm-hmm. And then when labor became expensive, it went to Taiwan or Korea. And then as those economies grew, they found new sources of cheap labor as well. And China and Vietnam are the places that everybody's gone to. What's going to happen when China develops a huge middle class?
Oh, China will definitely develop a huge middle class. But, as you know, China has a population of 1.2 billion people. And even by the most optimistic projections, in the by 2030, they'll have 300 to 400 million middle-class people.
So it won't slow down their economy when labor costs keep on going up?
Yeah, I think, but your question raises an important point that one of the most brilliant economists, Joseph Schumpeter, told us that in capitalism, you also have creative destruction. Just as the horse and buggy had to make way for the automobile when Ford invented the motor car, in the same way, we will see a lot of creative destruction taking place as new, more competitive economies come into line. And this is where both America and Europe will have to adapt to.
It's been predicted that the Chinese middle class will be larger than the entire population of the United States by 2030. That's not all that far off.
No, not at all. And now it's not. It may even happen faster, as you know. I mean, take for example, countries are measured on the basis of their currencies. If the Chinese yuan appreciates, it'll be an amazing difference.
Is this just an economic thing? Because China also has often been seen as a political competitor to the West. We can get into the Chinese approach to economics and politics in a little while. But do you see this as a potential for conflict as the Eastern Hemisphere and especially China continues to rise?
No, actually, I'm very optimistic.
I mean, it's a nuclear power, and India is as well.
Yes, but the most important thing to bear in mind is that China and India want to emerge in the same way as Japan and Germany emerged after World War II. I think it's important to understand why World War II followed World War I. World War II followed World War I because when Japan and Germany emerged in the 1930s, there wasn't a rules-based order. They could not expand their sphere of influence without going out to conquer and colonize. But the rules changed after 1945. America gave a huge gift to the world when it created the 1945 rules-based order. And with that rules-based order, Japan and Germany emerged peacefully on a level playing field, created large economies without disrupting the world order. In the same way, India and China will do so, and they'll play by Western rules.
Well, you talked earlier about a march to modernity. Is that also a march to westernization, or are distinctions have to be made?
Oh, a very important distinction, because I think in most Western minds, there's an automatic association between modernization and westernization. And one of the, I guess, the most painful parts of my book for a Western reader is the chapter on de-Westernization, where I mentioned that in Asia you can have modernization and de-Westernization at the same time. And that's the kind of paradox that's very difficult for the Western mind to grasp at this stage.
Well, it was a subject of debate in Japan for a long time, and people decided whether to wear kimono or not, whether to live in Japanese-style houses or whether to live in more modern houses, and still hasn't been resolved 100%.
But Japan is still culturally confused.
Is Japan an exception?
Japan is, I think, the exception to what's happening in Asia, because Japan was, on the one hand, the first Asian country to join the Western club and therefore was ahead of the rest of Asia. But when I go to Tokyo, I tell my Japanese friends, I've said that for the last 150 years, you've been on the right bus of history, the Western bus. Today, there's a new bus of history leaving the station, the Asian bus, and it's time for you to switch.
Well, you write about a rules-based order. You can explain that in a moment, but doesn't that have a Western bias?
Definitely, but if the rules are applied equally both to the West and the East, then there's no reason why the rules cannot be acceptable to the West and East. It's when the West refuses to live by the rules that it has created, that's when the problems begin.
Well, the West also was the conqueror of the East for a long time. You talked about China and India as being two dominant powers for a very long time economically, and then suddenly in serious decline, and both were affected by imperialism. Did that change the mindset in those two countries?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I won't go so far as Karl Marx, who said that British colonial rule was the best thing that happened to India. But I would definitely say that the painful, traumatic experiences that they went to was part of the labor pains that they had to go through to change and modernize. But, you know, what's amazing about China and India is that even though both were, India was, as you know, colonized and China had settlements carved out of it, and the Chinese had the British coming in 1840 saying, we want to buy your tea, please accept opium in return. And when the Chinese said no, their ports were bombarded and they had to accept British opium as payment for Chinese tea. You would expect a lot of resentment, but there isn't this resentment. Instead, there's a remarkable degree of confidence that they can march ahead without any bitterness.
But you write that when you were growing up, you absorbed the belief that Asians' lives were determined by fate. Was that as a result of what had gone on?
Oh, that's because I was brought up as a Hindu boy. Uh-huh. And
But often people have said that Hindu notions have actually held Indians back.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, Asians have to, honestly, you know, my first book was called Can Asians Think? And I asked my Asian friends this simple question. If you guys were so great in the year 1000, Asian societies, including Arabic societies, by the way, were so far ahead of Europe and America hadn't been discovered. That was in the year 1000. In the year 2000, Asians were so far behind. So clearly the Asians forgot to ask themselves what works and what doesn't work in their societies. Now they know.
How did you view Western-style modernity when you were a child in Singapore?
You know, one of the things that I say in my book, which will surprise many people, is that for me, the entry into modern civilization came when I got a flush toilet in my house at the age of 10. And believe me, if you live in an era without flush toilets, when you have a metal bin being removed from your house every 24 hours, you can feel a dramatic transformation in your life when you have flush toilets. And this is what many Asians are still dreaming of having.
Kishore Mahbubani is dean and professor in the practice of public policy at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. He's had a distinguished diplomatic career, and he's also the author of Can Asians Think, which he just told us. He has written a new book now, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East, published by Public Affairs. Stay with us for more. We're back with Kishore Mahbubani, who's written a book called The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East, published by Public Affairs. You visited China for the first time in 1980?
Yes, I did, yes.
I'm assuming the country has changed remarkably since then. But hadn't China already tried to modernize with the Great Leap Forward? What was wrong with that approach?
Well, the Great Leap Forward proved to be a great leap backward for China. Indeed, it wreaked enormous amount of disaster for China. The critical change came when China implemented the four modernizations. I actually saw what China was like before the four modernizations.
So it was Deng Xiaoping.
Yes, with Deng Xiaoping. You know, I remember when I went to Beijing, I went for a haircut, and the barber took 1 hour to cut my hair. And I said, "Why so long?" He said, "Whether I do 5 haircuts, 10 haircuts, 20 haircuts, I get paid the same. It's an iron rice bowl. Why work hard?" But the minute Deng Xiaoping introduced free market economics and incentives for working harder, China has developed the world's fastest growing economy for 30 years. That's remarkable for the world's most populous country to have the world's fastest growing economy. Is as unnatural as watching the fattest boy in the class win a 100-meter race.
To some degree, it's because of urbanization. Of course, the cities are growing incredibly fast.
The cities are growing because the people can go to the cities and get new jobs and succeed and prosper.
In the past, you couldn't go into many cities. But now a city like Shenzhen has grown remarkably.
Yeah, Shenzhen indeed has grown even much faster than Singapore, which is in itself an economic miracle. And Shenzhen today, it used to be a little quiet, sleepy village. In fact, I remember visiting Hong Kong before in the 1970s and looking across the fence across the border. You know, you can't do that. You know, you can go to the fence and look across the border. And all you saw was plain fields. Now you see this remarkable industrial city.
11 million people.
Yep.
But it has come at a price. Deng Xiaoping didn't implement human rights along with the economic changes. You write, had the students protesting in Tiananmen Square succeeded, China might have suffered as much as Russia. So are you implying that a nonviolent democratic revolution in the early 90s would have been bad for China?
Well, China learned a big lesson in history from what happened in Russia. And they have observed that when Russia went overnight, you know, from a communist party state to a democracy, look what happened. There was an economic implosion. The life expectancy went down. Infant mortality rates went up. All the other social indicators indicated a major breakdown. The Russian economy shrank to the size of Belgium. And the best test for this is to ask Russians. If you ask the Russians, they will tell you, do you think Russia should have adopted the road adopted by Gorbachev, which is to change the political system before changing the economic system? or to adopt the road taken by Deng Xiaoping, which is to change the economic system before changing the political system, the Russians will tell you, we wish we had taken the Chinese road.
But, of course, the Russians also did a kind of economic shock therapy. There were many people who were suggesting that Russia try to develop a more integrated economic approach, a la the Scandinavian countries, more of a welfare state kind of approach. Instead, they just got rid of everything, and they let anyone who didn't have a chance to grab a piece of the action suffer.
Yes. In fact, the tragedy about Russia is that Russia took the wrong road of history twice in the 20th century. First, when Karl Marx said to them, you cannot go from feudalism to communism overnight, you have to become capitalist first. They ignored the advice of Karl Marx and suffered 70 years of state-run communism. And then they took the wrong road again in the 1990s. And if you want to understand why the Russians today are so bitter towards the West, you have to step into the shoes of the Russians, who feel that at a time in the 1990s when they were suffering so much, in real terms, economic terms, social terms, political terms, the West was just cheering them on, saying, isn't it wonderful, you're a democracy. And that's why whenever you use the word democracy vis-a-vis Russia, they get very bitter and angry.
Well, we now have an autocratic government, growingly autocratic, with Vladimir Putin. Singapore has had a booming economy with a country that is kind of autocratic. The message I'm getting here is if you want to have an effective economy, you have to have a semi-dictatorship.
If that's the message you're getting, then is the clearly I'm not sending the right message across. Let me make two points here. The first point is that in the long run, all societies have to become democratic. There is no question about the destination. The only question is, how do you get there? And I think the big lesson in history that you've seen in the 1990s is that countries that tried to switch overnight, Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Russia, all suffered. But the second point is a much more important point, you know. There is in the Western mind still a kind of black and white view of the world, you know. You're either democratic or you're autocratic, and there's no choice some in between. And, you know, just like the Eskimo can see many shades of white in the snow, the Western mind has got to see many more shades of grey in the world of tomorrow. I mean, take Singapore, for example. Singapore has had elections every 5 years. The government gets only 60% of the vote. 40% still vote against the government consistently. Now, clearly, it is not...
Those are people who want to chew gum on the street.
Yes, we don't allow chewing gum. We cane American boys. We adopt a very tough regime on discipline matters. But there's no doubt that even if Jimmy Carter flew into Singapore with 10,000 election observers, the government would win the elections, you know. So you have to get to understand a world which is no longer black and white. And that's the challenge for the Western mind.
My guest is Kishore Mahbubani, Mahbubani. His latest book, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, many people said that as the Chinese economy grew, the country would become more democratized. We haven't seen that. So perhaps that was another Western fantasy?
Oh, that shows a massive Western misunderstanding of what's happening in China. You know, I have a whole chapter where I describe seven layers of freedom in China. And from the Chinese point of view, if you do not have food, right? And many Chinese, by the way, didn't have food for centuries. When you begin to get assurance of food supply, when you begin to have a shelter over your head, when you can begin to send your children to school, everything increases your human freedom. The West only thinks of political freedoms. But before you get to the political freedoms, you need all kinds of basic human freedoms, and China has provided it. But the best sign of how China has transformed itself, I mean, everybody sees China as a communist party-run dictatorial state. If that's the case, why are the leading universities in America rushing to have partnerships with Peking University, with Tsinghua University, with Fudan Universities? How can you have open, thriving, creative universities if China is still a closed society? It has opened.
Well, many Chinese students have studied in the United States over the past 30 years, and only a third of them have returned to China. So the others obviously do feel that they will have to live in a more restricted environment. But part of the problem in China also seems to me to be that it had really no legal system in place and now is trying to come up with one, but it doesn't seem to be all that effective at times. And sometimes, at least through Western eyes, the good get punished and the bad wind up getting more money.
Two things. The Chinese who are not going back to China still remain a tremendous resource for China and for India and for the rest of Asia.
Because they send money back?
Not just that they send money back, but if you look at all the new investments that are taking place in India, many of them are people who lived in Silicon Valley and have now decided to go back and apply their skills and their money to creating new industries in China and India. So I think that's not a loss at all to China and India. But your rule of law is a very important point. And here I agree with you that China still has some ways to go before it moves from what I call rule by law to rule of law. And these are two distinct regimes. China's got to move to the second.
One of the sources of tension, as I see it, is in trade. And it often has to do with preaching free markets and then putting up all sorts of tariffs to protect your own markets.
Yeah. This is why we are at a remarkably plastic moment of world history now. You know, it's the decisions we make today that will determine how the 21st century evolves. And one problem we have today is that all the custodians of the international economic institutions remain in Western hands. They are still run by the West. At a time when many Western populations are losing faith that they can actually compete with China and India on the basis of free market economics. And that creates a very dangerous situation for the world because we need to maintain this open trade regime in the world to keep the world peaceful.
Is that loss of faith based on reality or on misperceptions?
Oh, I think a lot of it is due to misperceptions. I mean, I'm absolutely confident. You see, everybody thinks that the world economy is a fixed pie and your share will diminish or decrease. But the global economy is growing by leaps and bounds. And the demand for many sophisticated Western products, I mean, look at the demand for French wine, for American Boeing aeroplanes. I mean, Boeing can hardly manufacture enough planes to supply to Asia. So there will always be products in the West for which there'll be a great demand in the East. But there are some sectors like textiles don't try to compete with the Chinese in textiles.
Do you think that part of the problem is that after the fall of communism, there was a false optimism? We had Francis Fukuyama's end of history and all of the stuff that followed that. I don't think anybody, anyone believes in that theory anymore. But there was this incredible optimism, the New World Order. And then it just hasn't panned out the way people imagine?
You know, one of the biggest shocks to me, you know, I studied Western philosophy. And so I always believed that the Western mind was always the most open mind in the world. And to see the West engage in a massive exercise of self-deception that has now carried on for almost 20 years, you know. The West believed that at the end of the Cold War, the rest of the history had ended and the rest of the world had no choice but to become carbon copies or clones of the West. Now, that's a massive exercise of self-deception. This belief that 12% of the world's population who live in the West can make the rest of the 88% of the world's population, make them in their own image. I mean, what are you dreaming of? Don't these people have their own cultures, thoughts, civilizations? And they're now finally re-emerging.
Do you think there's also an edge in Asia because its new industrialization is right now? It is, you know, where, for example, our steel industry suffered because after the war, Japan implemented new techniques, and we were stuck with the old pre-war techniques, and eventually we became so much less efficient. We just lost the competitive edge.
The biggest edge that Asians have today is optimism. I mean, if you want to meet the most optimistic young people in the world, go to China, go to India. They're absolutely convinced that tomorrow is theirs and they can do as well as anybody else. By the way, the most pessimistic young people today are in Europe who do not believe that they will have a better lifetime than theirs. But your point about the steel industry is a good one. The Asians today have a capacity to learn and implement best practices from all over the world.
On the other hand, many people have been concerned that the rise of China and India's economic powers will have a devastating impact on the global environment. And we're already seeing that sort of thing in China. The pollution in Beijing is probably going to have a major effect on the Olympics. Mm.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. And this is where I think the good thing about the world waking up to the challenge of global warming is that the world is now realizing that all of us are on the same boat. And if you're sailing on the same boat and you breathe the same air, you want to make sure that the air that's circulating in the boat is good for everyone else to breathe. And this is where we need a new global social contract between Asia and the West. The Asians should take responsibility for the new flows of greenhouse gas emissions, and the West should take responsibility for the stock of greenhouse gas emissions that the West has put in the atmosphere over the last two centuries or so. I think we can work out a new global social contract, but both sides must compromise.
There are still many people in this country who believe that it's all a farce. There's an ad in today's New York Times about a conference which suggests that global warming is really just a hoax.
I saw that ad too, and I was shocked.
Kishore Mahbubani's book, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.